Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan, standing in for Josh Fennett. On today's episode, we focus in on one of the oldest design materials, wood, and ask how designers and architects are using it today. First up,
really beautiful timber. It comes up beautifully once it's finished. It's one of the most satisfying parts. It's putting the oil on. I always look forward to that the most.
We delve into the depths of London's Somerset House, where a young designer and maker has created a timber terrazzo for the 21st century. Next, we head to Melbourne to meet a design-minded instrument maker rethinking the drum pad using wood. Then,
you sort of turn the corner and there's this huge wooden building, and it just fits really perfectly and adds kind of the calm of the area. It looks really amazing because the whole thing is clad in these kind of wooden shingles.
Monocle's Jamie Waters joins me in the studio to discuss his recent visit to the HQ of Folkhelm in Sweden, a company using timber to build houses. And finally, we head back to Australia, this time to Sydney, where a set of wooden escalators in an underground train station has caused some controversy. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Wood is one of the oldest design materials, but in the modern age it has to compete with a vast range of alternatives, both natural and man-made, that are more durable, less flammable, and, some would say, better looking. So what role does wood have to play in contemporary design? That's a question we seek to answer today. Connor Taylor is a maker and designer based here in London who's invented a new design material using wood. It's called Ferrezzo, and Connor describes it as the timber terrazzo. It utilises beautiful hardwood chips to recreate the aesthetic of traditional terrazzo, which is made using stone chippings and has a far wider range of applications than its forebear. I headed to Connor's studio in the basement of Somerset House in central London to find out more. Connor, thanks very much for joining me. Can you just begin by telling me a little bit about your background and how you reached where you are today?
So I'm actually a fine art graduate, although I've ended up very much in a design field. My family are all architects, makers, designers, engaged in the arts in some way. So I've really grown up around making and designing and looking. And after graduating from Falmouth, I worked in a few workshops doing a bit of everything, and I've become sort of a jack of all trades. And while working for a carpenter, I was processing a huge amount of timber, and you end up with a lot of funny offcuts, because obviously planks and wood is a natural material, and just put away in the back of my head that there must be a use for these, as well as when you plane planks, you end up with huge amounts of waste, this beautiful little curls, spirals, very visually interesting. And at the same time as doing all these other jobs, I was and am managing a materials library, so I was exposed to all sorts of fascinating things, and I've always really loved terrazzo. It's got a kind of classic styling and something also pleasingly modern in the really kind of modernist sense of the words. And these ideas just stewed in the back of my head for a while, and I had some leftover resin from a project I was doing for a restaurant and just started experimenting, prototyping, and months of trial and error later, I was heading towards something a bit more usable, and I'd always strived not so much to produce a portfolio object or a design object, although those are valid things. I wanted to make something that was a viable material that could be used all over the place. It was versatile and beautiful without sacrificing any of its structural integrity or material properties.
So if you mind if I jump in, let's just go back a bit and talk a little bit about what terrazzo is and the history of terrazzo and what it looks like. And then let's talk about what this product, your product, how it draws on the aesthetic of terrazzo to produce something new.
So originally terrazzo is produced by quarry workers. Obviously quarries produce huge amounts of marble chips and waste material, and they're still beautiful chunks of a natural material. So they just started laying them with cement on their own floors and grinding them down. And eventually some entrepreneurial soul thought, well, we could start using really beautiful marbles for this and making it for itself. And now you see it everywhere, especially in London. I mean, we're in central London now, and in every tube station there's terrazzo and loads of the floors and restaurants and things. I mean, I really enjoyed its aesthetics, basically, that you get this random organic pattern, the wonderful stone material that really makes very good use of the stone grain without being an overwhelming bookmatch piece of marble, but it still has that hand of the maker, the human thing, that it is a manufactured product without sacrificing too much of the natural material. And I wanted something that was really visually appealing, but also made use of these two contrasting qualities.
What's your business model? First of all, what markets are you targeting? Who do you think is going to be interested in this and why?
So the markets are very much architects and designers. I suppose it's going to be less likely that the end user will be the person choosing it, although that's not to say that won't happen. I mean, my first project was actually by chance a private individual who just happened to see a sample. I was at another meeting in a public space. But I will be going around the materials libraries and architects and designs and taking them sample packs and just seeing where it goes. And I'm really interested in collaborating, because although I'm making this material and running this business, I don't have the time necessarily to be designing furniture with it or to be pushing interior projects. And I think one of the next stages for me will be to work with other designers and architects of a similar career stage to me and ask them to make something beautiful for me. And I can provide the material at, you know, close to cost, and they can make something lovely, and together we get something great, hopefully.
Connor took me down to his workshop to show me how he fabricates Ferrezzo.
We're trying out some samples today for some nice little projects we've got coming up and some new ranges as well that we've got planned. I'm really interested in design that has a bit of a story, so a lot of the new ranges are going to be based around parts of London that I love and experiences I've had in the city. And so we're working with today with a bit of walnut that's a really lovely, really beautiful timber, great color variation, and it comes up beautifully once it's finished. It's one of the most satisfying parts. It's putting the oil on. I always look forward to that the most. With our mixture complete, we're going to cast this little sample, and in a few days' time, we get to have the fun of revealing it and seeing what's inside and seeing how it's laid out. Oh, there you go.
Fantastic. And you've not got the mould cast it now?
That'll sit quite happily on its own for a little bit, and it's quite good to let the resin really get into the timber. And I'll put together the moulds now and cast it and put it somewhere out of the way, nice and flat, and it'll be ready in a few days' time.
Connor Taylor there, talking about his invention, Ferrezzo. You can find out more at ferrezzo.co.uk. Next up, we look at a company using wood to rethink a distinctly modern invention. The instruments that are used to make electronic music are rarely things of beauty. Most of them have a distinctly utilitarian aesthetic, with endless rows of knobs and flashing buttons. That said, there are a handful of boutique manufacturers trying a different approach. One of them is a Melbourne-based company called Hundo. Co-founded by artists and musicians Henry and Jack Madden, they make beautifully designed instruments in Melbourne out of Tasmanian oak. Although they do dabble in the acoustic with a handsome marimba, their main instrument is a drum pad. Monocle's Adrian Craddock sat down with Henry Madden to find out more.
It started through these art projects that I was doing, where I was creating large amounts of instruments for groups of people to play together in a gallery context. And once I started working on the electronic side of the instrument, it became obvious that they could possibly become a product that people would want.
So can you describe the instruments that you make?
Our main instrument is a drum pad. Essentially, it's an electronic instrument that you can plug into a computer and play samples of drums or sounds or chords. And you can play them with mallets, so it's very tactile. And we also make these acoustic marimbas, which are very portable and strong.
How would you describe the aesthetic of them. I mean, they almost look like Japanese minimalism or something like that.
Definitely. They've got a minimalist vibe to them, or maybe a Scandinavian feel, especially the curved marimbas that I make. People think they look like amazing Scandinavian hot tubs or something. But yeah, they're very plain. The aesthetic is of Tasmanian oak, and they're just very, very clean lines. Yeah, I'm trying to achieve a sort of magical aesthetic where they look almost impossible. They look like they shouldn't work, but they do.
How different are your products to, you know, normal drum pads? It seems like aesthetics aren't something that is super important to most drum pad manufacturers. Why have you taken a different tack?
With the Hundo Basic, which is our drum pad, I was definitely thinking about stage shows. And I've had lots of experience performing on stage where you have these electronic instruments with 1,000 knobs or 1,000 buttons, and you can sometimes hit the wrong one. And you have absolutely no idea how to recover on stage because they're built for such incredible features. I wanted these instruments to be far more like tools, like a hammer or something that you know exactly how it's going to work every single time. And I think that really sets these particular instruments apart.
And I guess you should never underestimate how important visuals are in music, you know. And I guess your instruments could potentially be part of that. They could add to the atmosphere of a show. Is that something that you maybe think about?
Yeah, absolutely. It lends a touch of wood to a setup that might not have any. And it's a very organic object that just sort of floats there. And I think to see them on stage, people often wonder what they are, how they work.
How do you think the aesthetic of an instrument affects the way it's played?
I think it's huge. I think the way that you value an instrument is the way that you play it. And I think you can do incredible things with any instrument, no matter how it looks or feels or how much it costs. But I do think there's a huge benefit to sticking with an instrument and knowing all of its characteristics. I think that's a very beautiful thing. And you can find that with people that have had a violin for a very long time or the same drum kit for their entire life. They can make it sound better than anything else.
How do you go about doing all the electronics? Do you do that yourself?
At first, I made them almost entirely myself on top of these chips that are sort of readily available. But then I realised that there's a lot you can do with the internet. You can contact people through Alibaba and you can start having things made. And the quality of the instruments immediately improved. And it was amazing that first time seeing something I designed. I mean, I've designed things out of wood, but it was the first time I designed something out of wires. And seeing that come together was really special.
Coming into your studio here, it seems like the studio of a furniture designer almost. You know, there are saws around us and, you know, there's a lot of wood. Do you think that is what kind of makes you different in a way that you've had this background where you also understand electronics? I imagine that's quite rare.
There is a lot of amazing electronic projects out there that people do, but they're often not presented in the best way. And I guess Hundo is an exercise in presentation in a lot of ways. And yeah, like I really was studying a fine art degree, but I came out with these engineering skills. So I think maybe that is rare.
What kind of people have expressed interest so far?
Lots of percussionists have. We've got electronic producers that are interested. And often people that have never played an instrument before have seen us on Instagram or come to our exhibitions and said, you know, I want to get started. And we're actually doing some classes with kids next week, so we're going to see how the instruments work in that context.
Can you describe your relationship with these instruments? Do you find yourself in your studio playing them quite often?
Yeah, I do. I can't stop. I get to play them. I mean, I test them all as well, but I started making them because I wanted these instruments, and it's been amazing to see that other people are interested in them, but I can't stop playing them myself.
Henry Madden of Hundo Instruments there speaking to Adrian Craddock. And you can find out more about Hundo at hundo.com.au. Monocle's Jamie Waters spends most of his time on the lookout for new fashion finds, but he recently took a break from his sartorial duties to travel to Sweden and pay a visit to the HQ of Folkhem, a company focused on building houses out of wood. They're evangelists for wood as a construction material, believing it to be superior in almost every respect to conventional alternatives, from construction time to acoustic properties. And, they say, it has significant environmental benefits. Jamie joined me in the studio to explain more. Jamie, thanks so much for joining me again. To begin with, could you just tell me who Folkhem are and what they do?
Yeah, so they're a property developing company. They're several decades old. They're Swedish, based in Stockholm. But they're really interesting because they've kind of reinvented themselves in the last 12 or 13 years. And in, I think it was 2005, they started basically solely working on wooden buildings. So it's mostly wooden high-rise apartment blocks. And it's interesting because they are a small company. So I think it's a really kind of clever move for a small property developer to carve your own niche. And they've kind of become known in Sweden and sort of Scandinavia as the firm that's working on all these high-rise wooden projects. Their sort of claim to fame is they recently completed this 8-story apartment block, which is the highest timber tower in Sweden. And I visited them at their office, which is in this building, and it's incredible.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit more in a bit. I'm interested to hear about it. But just before that, I'm interested in getting your perspective on wood as a building material, because I believe that it was outlawed in many Scandinavian countries in spite of once being prevalent because of its unfortunate capacity to catch fire. What is the story of wood as a building material? What do you know of it? And what's different about the technology which is being used today that makes it feasible?
Yeah, it's got this really long and interesting history in Scandinavia. So it was obviously the historic material for all buildings. And then I think it was 1890, it was outlawed because of there were a lot of fires. So it was outlawed for apartment buildings. And then I think the big sort of technological breakthrough came with the invention of cross-laminated timber, which was, I think, in the 1990s. And basically what that is it's kind of like they stack these timber planks at right angles to one another and glue them together. So it's sort of really compact. And it just means that you end up with this very solid structure that's basically fire resistant. So that brought about this huge change and resulted in the legalization of wood in sort of high-rise buildings. It was interesting talking to these property developers and architects who worked on this building because they said that that is one of the main sort of questions and concerns that people have when they're looking to invest in a high-rise wooden building. It's still about the fire, and that's they've had to do a lot to kind of allay people's fears about these kind of this issue, the fire resistance and fire issue.
And what did you find when you reached, was it Stockholm that you went to?
Yeah, and
you visited the Folkhem HQ,
yeah.
Which is wooden itself. Could you describe the building to me? And I think you also met the architect, didn't you? Tell me what they told you about the building, what your impressions of it were.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So it's in this place called Sundby Bay, which is kind of like in the suburbs of Stockholm. Very quiet, kind of leafy area. And then you sort of turn the corner and there's this huge wooden building and it just sort of fits really perfectly and adds to kind of the calm of the area. It looks really amazing because the whole thing is covered in wooden shingles. Obviously, the core structure is wood. The only thing that's not is there's a concrete base, which you have to have in order to kind of stabilize the building. But everything else, the internal core is wood, as are a lot of buildings sort of around the world. But the interesting thing is that it's also clad in these kind of wooden shingles. So it looks like a wooden building. And I think that's really interesting. They've really played on that. And that was a very conscious decision. And they said that the architects, who's a firm called Vingard Architects, you know, they're based in Stockholm, them and the property developers and Folkhem met with sort of hospitals and all these people doing public projects in other countries, which are made of wood, but explicitly made to not look like they're made from wood. And I think this is a really interesting contrast. And they said to all these people, you're making this amazing wooden building. Why are you making it so that it's painted or it's got some sort of veneer or coating something so it doesn't look like wood? And they said, because wood is still thought of as the poor man's material. So people don't want to invest in it. So even if it's the core is wood, we don't want it to look like wood. Anyway, they've gone against the grain and they kind of tried to challenge these preconceptions. Obviously, this building looks beautiful and it will also age really beautifully. And I think having a natural material, it's very dynamic. So it was a red wood. So it was this sort of deep red colour when it started. And already it's becoming silvery. And within a couple of years, the whole thing will be like have this kind of silver patina, which I think is beautiful.
I've got two questions to finish up on. First of all, was the against the grain pun in your last answer intentional?
Absolutely.
And second of all, you know, talking about wood still being considered the poor man's material, are Folkhelm making wood sexy again? And if so, how are they doing it? Because I know that they're establishing quite deep links within the Swedish architecture community and getting a lot of young, impressive architects on board.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're definitely making it an attractive, kind of sexy material to use again. And the key to all of that, I mean, they're clever because they're working with the best of the best. So it's interesting because they've kind of got like 20 or I think 22 projects on the go at the moment. Almost all of them have a different architecture firm behind them. And if you look at those architecture firms, it's almost like a who's who of the most exciting dynamic firms at the moment. I mean, I mentioned Vingard, who worked on this one. And then there's Petra Gitt was another one. They've kind of scoured Sweden for the most exciting architects. And, you know, it's not a country with as many firms as, say, Denmark or something. So they've kind of worked hard to find out who's the best. So I think that's really clever. I just also want to quickly mention the big environmental impact, because this is one of their key things. It's not just about doing something different. It's about doing something that's kind of looking at a responsible footprint. And they basically said that, according to them, the construction industry is responsible for 50% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the world. And within that 50%, I think it's something like 80% happens during the construction of buildings. It's interesting because we all think of being like, you know, we're all about zero power buildings, you know, turning lights off and all that sort of thing. But they said 80% of all these emissions happen during the construction. Only 20% is when the building's in use. And that's because of concrete. So I think there's a really kind of legitimate and important environmental message underlying it all. They also look great. It's important that they look great because that's how it will catch on.
Finally, on today's show, we head back to Australia, this time to Sydney, where a piece of timber travel infrastructure is causing a ruckus. At Wynyard train station, there are four grand, rumbling wooden escalators, among the oldest in Australia, which transport travellers between levels of the station. Despite being heritage listed since 2009 and revered by locals, the escalator's future is in question amidst report of health and safety risks for modern-day commuters. From Sydney, Zoe Nalian reports.
They're iconic both in sight and sound. The escalators at Wynyard train station in Sydney's CBD date back to the 1930s, with a refurbishment in the 1950s. They're tall, grand, and add a sense of charm, otherwise absent from the daily commute.
The next train to arrive on platform.
The Wynyard escalators were built in the 1930s, and they're stunning long escalators with timber decking, which is the timber that curves up between the escalators, and timber treads. And the timber treads are slats. They're about a centimetre tall by a centimetre wide, with about a centimetre or more between them. They're really stunning escalators. There's a bank of four of them.
Matt Devine is an architect and heritage specialist based in Sydney.
So these escalators were actually some of the earliest escalators in Sydney and in Australia. And they are distinctive for the use of timber, and also their streamlined aesthetic, which is very typical of the 1930s. We sometimes describe it as modern. It's a sort of a modern aesthetic, sort of slightly ocean liner style. They were upgraded significantly in the 1950s, and the three bays were converted into four bays. The whole of the actual mechanism was upgraded, and they applied some of the characteristics of the 1930s escalators, such as the timber treads and the timber decking, to these new escalators in the 1950s. Current escalators are different. They generally have a different angle, and they're usually all stainless steel and glass, very modern, as transparent as possible. Whereas one of the distinctive characteristics of these escalators is the solid decking between each escalator.
In the 1930s, darker coloured timber was used for the escalator steps, thought to have been mahogany. Then, when the escalators were modernised in the 1950s, the wood was changed to a lighter coloured blonde timber. The escalators were recognised as important heritage items in 2009.
Don't think of these sorts of things as important parts of our heritage. We often think of a historical house or an old farm as an important part of our heritage, but we don't necessarily think of infrastructure such as railway stations.
But despite their age charm and heritage listing, the escalators pose safety risks for modern commuters. From women's long skirts and stilettos getting caught to guide dogs' claws becoming trapped and causing injury. With an estimated 150,000 people travelling on the escalators at Wynyard every day, these safety risks have to be taken seriously. I asked Matt if it's possible to marry beautiful design and architecture with modern pragmatism.
Often it's easier to marry them when it's a brand new design, but at the same time, it is almost always possible to resolve these problems in older places as well. And there are solutions that are being considered for the escalators at Wynyard. The main solution, even though it does involve the loss of quite a bit of original fabric, is to install new escalators in this same location, either use existing or similar timber for the decking, which is the timber that goes between the escalators. Unfortunately, the wooden treads are going to have to go because they're the most problematic component.
So what happens when heritage landmarks clash with safety?
Well, we gave this a careful consideration. We did put it in a submission from the National Trust on the development, and we had to look quite carefully at it.
That's Graeme Quint. He's the Director of Advocacy at the National Trust of Australia in New South Wales.
We felt that changing to the safer treads, the closer together metal treads, wasn't a major change to the escalators in that they'd be keeping the general look, the form, the height, the shape, the timber, and we felt that it was a fairly minor change, which unfortunately you just have to take into account nowadays with safety and health issues.
But some aren't so happy with the slow changes to the escalators' design. Guide Dogs New South Wales has been prompting train authorities to make changes to the vintage escalators for 16 years. Graeme White is the CEO and is happy action is finally being taken.
We would like this to have been done years ago. It's been slow moving. These things aren't cheap, and moving any bureaucracy is a slow and painful exercise. But we have a really good minister here who's got on the bandwagon and really helped us and pushed it along. And the treads are quite wide. Dogs can get their claws caught in the tread. And we have four instances in the last 3 years where the dogs have had their claws torn out. In a relatively modern city, it's really inexcusable.
Matt Devine thinks if done properly, the Wynyard escalators can be fixed and retain their golden era characteristics.
Places are important for the layers of history that they represent and that they have. And something that's all completely new may be wonderful, but something that has little aspects of the past in the built fabric are quite rich and complex. They tell a lot about the people who live there, they tell a lot about the way things have been done in the past, and they just make it so much more diverse.
This train will stop at Wynyard.
Zoe Nalien there, reporting from Sydney. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to email me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com and SoundCloud. And also iTunes. If you're there, leave us a review. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.